Welcome to the Voices in Recovery podcast. Voices in Recovery is produced by Freedom's Path Recovery Society, a registered Canadian charity. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider a donation at www.freedomspathrecoverysociety.ca. All donations go directly to assisting Freedom's Path and providing services free of charge and helps us keep the podcast going. We are grateful for any and all donations. This podcast discusses difficult topics such as childhood abuse, drug and alcohol use, sexuality, sexualized trauma, and more. If you are under the age of 18, please speak with your legal guardian prior to listening. The opinions expressed during the podcast are those of the individual and not those of Voices in Recovery or Freedom's Path Recovery Society. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcast.
This podcast is being recorded on the traditional land of the Blackfoot Confederacy. This consists of the Kainai, Piikani, Siksika, and the Blackfeet in the U.S. We acknowledge the Stoney Nakoda, which consists of the Bearspaw, Morley, and Chiniki. We acknowledge the Tsuut'ina who are Dene, and the Métis Inuit status and non-status from all of Turtle Island, and those who are visiting. We are all treaty people.
Excellent. So, Wendy Walker, welcome. And thank you for opening this podcast with one of your own songs.
You're welcome, and I'm really grateful that you've invited me, so right thank on. You for that.
You're welcome.
So this is a new piece called If I Never Come Home. Mm-hmm. And I wrote the song just so a while ago after I'd given a keynote speech at this conference. And when I was giving my speech, I'm not a very good follower of speech, mm-hmm. so I'm better at ad-libbing sometimes. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I had said to the audience, I don't know how many of you will ever have to go home and have this conversation with your children. Mm-hmm. And the conversation may start off something like this, if I never come home, mm-hmm. right? And I know it's a conversation I have with my children, mm-hmm. because being in the arts and, you know, leaving places at weird hours, I've mm-hmm. had some weird experiences,
for
and,
sure.
right? So, and as we know, with a number I heard the other day, we're apparently upwards of close to, you know, almost 10,000 murdered, missing, Indigenous, exploited people in this country, yeah. right? So
I would even say that's probably a low number.
Yeah. Oh, it's. I would think so too, yeah. because the police aren't always good at
terrible at it, especially when it comes to Indigenous people.
Yeah. I'm just gonna grab a lozenger thing because
sure.
I love them.
Yeah, for sure. I'm gonna grab a bottle of water. Can I get you a water?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's not cold. That's even better.
No, it's just.
No, perfect.
Yeah, it's just lukewarm. It's just
no,
normal.
No, it's perfect.
There you go.
Most singers won't take a cold water.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little scratchy because I wasn't. Yeah. I mean, I didn't warm up.
I think you'll be fine.
Yeah.
But in all honesty, she didn't warm up.
If I never come home, I want you to know how it wasn't my choice. Someone took my life from me. If I never come home, don't listen to what they say, you know they haven't been on our side. They may say I ran away. If I never come home, they don't seem to care about our women who are out there. It's time to bring them home, lay them to rest, let their families try to move on. If I never come home. If I never come home, oh, please look for me. Search the landfills, ditches, the rivers. This is where my body may be. If I never come home, they don't seem to care about our women who are out there. It's time to bring them home, lay them to rest, let their families try to move on. They don't seem to care about our people who are out there. It's time to bring them home, lay them to rest, let their families try to move on. Bring them home. Bring them home.
Me a little emotional too. That and you wrote that specifically regarding missing and murdered Indigenous women and Two-Spirit.
Yeah, exploited. And it's
wow, it was powerful.
Yeah, it was a tough piece to write. Mm-hmm. But I'm grateful to have had the opportunity to put some lyrics and some and a melody together in a way that other people who are non-Indigenous mm-hmm. can hear and understand that this is a real thing. Mm-hmm. And as an Indigenous woman who has had to have that conversation with my children, because I was a single mom with four kids, and so my children needed to know that if I didn't come back, that something, it wasn't my choice.
Yeah, something happened.
Something happened to me.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think when you put it into that kind of a context, then people can hear it.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And that's the power of music,
yeah.
Right? The power of music is that it can reach places and spaces within people's hearts and minds and souls mm-hmm. that politicians, for example,
yeah.
can't reach.
Well, that's for sure.
Right? So...
That's
so,
for sure.
I'm just starting that process of we're raising the money to record that song mm-hmm. So that we can put it out there so that people can have access to
yeah.
it and share it, right? So that more people become aware, because if there was almost 10,000 non-Indigenous or Caucasian women mm-hmm. missing, the outcry in this country would be huge.
It would never have gotten to 10,000.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah.
Something would have been done.
Yeah.
But because it's Indigenous women, mm-hmm. and then there's times when people only see Indigenous people who are on the streets, for example.
Yeah.
They don't see the rest of us who are doing really good work out there.
And even the folks on the street are a result of a system that has tried to kill them.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, and is still trying to kill them. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that is, and that's an interesting observation, because you're right, there's all different levels of different communities, right? At
yeah.
different places. I just think that it's overwhelmingly indigenous humans on the street. The numbers are overwhelming, right? In terms of comparison to other demographics.
Oh, absolutely. But when you look at community, especially in reserve, when you look at the poverty level, you look at the addiction rates, you look at the...
Is there any numbers on that? Do you know any numbers about that?
Around addiction and overdoses and deaths?
On the nations, yeah.
Not specific numbers. There's nations who are kind of keeping that a little quiet. Mm-hmm. But there are also nations in the province of Alberta who have put out states of emergency.
Yeah, didn't the Ochis put out?
Bigani did one a while ago. Mm-hmm. I know Muskoches, I was talking with Lily... Willie, a while ago, and Muskoches is looking at doing it that.
Okay.
But I can remember literally in the late 90s, I was doing some programming for them out at the, they have a television station. I don't know if it's still up and going, but it was called Cree TV.
Okay.
And I created a show, an hour show called Anuch, which really just brought... regional, provincial, federal issues that were actually important to the community and that the community might not know. Mm-hmm. So that included bringing guests on TV and whatnot. But right around that time is when the gangs, and it was Asian gangs, that first started to move in with drugs, bad drugs.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it was back in the day, people thought that pot was bad. Mm-hmm. Now you look at, oh my God, he's only smoking pot.
Yeah.
Right? It's so how that has changed.
Yeah, every generation demonizes their own stuff, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, having had conversations with folks there who were in positions to have done something about it, didn't really believe that it was going to be that bad.
I don't think anyone could have, to be honest. Like, I mean, those of us who may have used drugs, like myself included, we might have known it was coming, like, that it was going to get worse.
Well, myself having, as a teenager, I lived on the streets of Vancouver. Mm. On Hastings and Granville and in that fun part of Vancouver. And drugs were bad then.
Yeah.
Right? Addiction was bad then.
Mm-hmm. I've only seen it get worse. That's my whole
point. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Just escalated so much.
I've had two of my own children who were addicted to very bad drugs. Mm-hmm. My eldest has recently got clean. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jesus. I guess it's the weekend to be thanking him.
You can thank whoever you want. I will not get in the way of that. Yeah, you're allowed to thank whoever you like.
but, you know, and having lost, I lost a niece and a granddaughter to fentanyl overdoses. So,
oh, I'm sorry
to hear that. It's not just my family. Like,
no,
how many,
I know.
How many families have been impacted?
Yeah.
And when we look at trauma, intergenerational trauma and poverty, it's a perfect recipe.
Mm. God, it sure seems like it.
Like it truly just is that perfect recipe. So if you're living in a community where you don't have access to transportation. So if we just look at our community surrounding Calgary, there's no bus services.
Mm-hmm.
You see people walking on roads or they're hitchhiking.
Yeah.
So if people don't have access to transportation, if they don't have access to good food, they don't have access to more than one psychologist in that community. And personally myself, I'm not a big believer, and no offense to any psychologists or psychiatrists out there, but I haven't seen
take it.
But I haven't seen where their work has made a difference.
Except to make things more complicated in some ways, yeah.
And then you can't have more than one because then it's a duplication of services, right? And so the Indian Act falls into all of that. But where I have seen people's lives change is when they've been able to find their way back to their own culture, their way back to their own ceremony.
Yeah. Culture's prevention.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah.
Right, 100%.
And so tell me how you came to be a musician and you came to be a part, maybe you've always been a musician, but how you came to be a part of like protest culture here in Calgary. Because I think that's how you got referred to me, right?
Okay.
Was through our common
friends.
Our common friends,
we have friends.
Right? we have common friends. And we're both like verbal and vocal about like freeing Palestine and ending the genocide.
Absolutely.
And, you know, how did you come to be here? Like, and I know you just did like two shows in a row last weekend,
yeah,
I think, because
you're
obviously like music is huge.
Yeah, it's becoming better.
Yeah, can you tell us more about that? Because I know this town, like one of the cops actually last week came up to me and said, this is becoming the protest town of Canada. And I said, well, that's got to tell you something about our police, doesn't it? And then I walked away.
Yeah. For me, protesting started actually when I was a kid in elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
I organized my first protest because they wanted to tell the girls how to dress.
Oh, interesting. Right. Okay.
Yeah, and it was, you know, and as, you know, a 12-year-old, I'm like, Chuck you Farley, not going to tell me what to do.
Chuck you Farley.
I don't know if we're allowed to say those other words.
You can say whatever you want. I'm going to swear. I'll just tell you that right now. I hope it's not offensive to you.
But it is not. I come from a swearing family.
Me too. Both of my Christian parents swore like truckers.
Yeah, right? Yeah. and actually, the F word was just a word. I didn't know it was a bad word until I went to white school.
Yeah.
So I organized my first one then, but I always found that way. I always had a sense of injustice. Mm-hmm. And even from being told what to do, like how to dress, mm-hmm. which we all lived in the bush, and they want us to wear skirts and dresses. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you live in the bush, that's just not practical.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
No, my dad was a hunter and a trapper, right? So so that was, I think we had a dress for church, mm-hmm. right? But So that kind of went on. And I actually have a lot of memories of organizing in this particular building.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Like,
right on. Because it's been here forever doing similar stuff. Yeah.
So oh my gosh. When did the Occupy Wall Street stuff get going? Which started, right, in New York.
Yeah.
And then really mushroomed and spread across North mm-hmm. America. And so there was meetings here that were being organized.
Okay.
And it was all white males who were doing the organizing. Mm-hmm. And I showed up in...
We're very organized white males. I'm not particularly organized, but
And there wasn't women. There wasn't women on the organizing, right? And there wasn't any Indigenous women. So I was, that time, I think I was the only Indigenous woman mm-hmm. at that time. And so kind of negotiated strongly mm-hmm. my way onto that committee. So we had a lot of meetings here up in the mm-hmm. big room.
Yeah.
We also took over Olympic Plaza.
Right on.
Right. We moved in. Mm-hmm. And I think we were there for almost a month.
That's right. I remember that.
Yeah. And we were living in tents. And mm-hmm. I had an apartment not too far from here. And so I didn't have any work. And I really had very little money. My cupboards were pretty bare. Mm-hmm. But I would come back to my place. And I'd go, okay, I've got a couple of cans of tomatoes. Oh, I still got a package of hamburger. Mm-hmm. Noodles, I can make a soup or something, mm-hmm. right? So different ones, myself and others would make soup and whatnot, and we'd take it down and we'd feed the people, mm-hmm. and we held our ground there for a while until it got to be a wee bit weird mm-hmm. towards the end, and then myself and others chose to leave that.
Got weird how? Can you elaborate, or?
There was one particular male who... was hitting on other Indigenous women because mm-hmm. women were coming to me and saying, this guy's hitting on me. Can you please get him to stop? We also found out that, and people were bringing their families, mm-hmm. right? There were other mm-hmm. organizers who brought their kids down.
Yeah.
And there was apparently two individuals in the camp who were not known to me, mm-hmm. but known to some others as... pedophiles.
Oh, hurting children, yeah.
Hurting children. And that's, I'm like, if we can't oust these people, mm-hmm. then I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And I didn't sign up for this.
No, for sure.
I
Nobody
signed,
did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I will say that at that time, when we did that protest, before we took over the Olympic Plaza, thousands of Calgarians showed up for that. Mm-hmm. It was a huge, huge rally.
Yeah. Unfortunately, if you have thousands of people, you do have a tendency to have a percentage of pedophiles. It's unfortunately the way the world is. Like, there's just that much sickness out there.
Well, right? And then, you know, like, certainly for Indigenous people who have been hugely impacted by pedophiles.
Oh. Yeah, and they're all dressed in robes and...
Yeah, yeah, and carry churches. Bibles.
Yeah.
Right? And do all that good God
work. The good work.
Yeah.
Quote, unquote, word. If you can't mm-hmm. see our quotations, it's good work.
Yeah. So that was not something I was willing to mm-hmm. To be a part of.
No doubt.
And there was a situation, and I always reminded them that, You need to understand that this plaza, this is where a lot of our homeless, mm-hmm. our houseless, I guess we, I guess that's the proper word today. But then we.
But back then it was homeless.
It was homeless. And I said, we need to be mindful that this is, we're in their space. Mm-hmm. And we need to be mindful about that. And we need to be mindful that, you know, there's going to be Indigenous people here. And if there's ever a situation that goes down, then you need to come and talk to me. You need to get Sarah Scout, or because by mm-hmm. now there was more of us. And one day, someone from the camp called the police to remove this older homeless couple. And they didn't come and tell us. We had no idea. We would have gone and talked to the people and found out. And so I went over to this older couple, and he said, my girl, I'm so sorry. He said, we didn't mean to be a bother. He said, we just wanted to sit here and have a little drink. Mm-hmm. He said, but we'll just sit and wait for the police.
Oh, and they were just, drinking, and that's why they got called on?
Yeah, and I just, I remember crying, and I just remember saying, fuck this. Yeah. This is bullshit.
Yeah.
Right? We're in their house.
Yeah.
And when you're in somebody's house, you don't get to call the rules.
The system doesn't look at it that way, though. The system doesn't think that anyone belongs there except for who they want to be there, right? And
Yeah,
and that's problematic for sure.
And then the other memories I have of this building. So then when the whole I Don't Know More movement got going, that was an exciting time. Holy shit, that was exciting. So the women, you know, the national women, the four women who came together, they did their first teach-in up at Muscogee's, I believe. And I can't remember if it was Sampson, Ermineskin, Montana, or Louisville. I forget which of those communities it was actually held in. And I got a call from Kim Weaselfat, who lives now in Fort McLeod. And she said, like, hey, me and Autumn and Summer, we're getting together. We need to do something. Are you in? I'm like, yeah, I'm in. So four women got together. We had 5 days before the Harper government was going to push through that omnibus bill. And what our particular focus in that omnibus bill was, there's buried way in that bill was he was taking off the protection of our water all across Canada.
That's sneaky shit.
Oh, yeah. So that's why they bury it, right? Because those MPs, they're not, and their helpers, they're not going to have time to read these huge...
They don't care anyway.
Yeah. So Kim, so we organized. We did it by telephone. Like from our apartments and our homes. And Kim says, I'm going to call these people, these white people who were organizers. I said, yeah, you could, but I think it's going to be a waste of time. But you do what you need to do, Kim, to feel good about this. So she made the call, and then she calls me back and says, yeah, they said that we can't do this because Occupy needed like months to organize. I said, we got 5 days. We got Moccasin Telegraph. We got our people. So in 5 days, we pulled off huge. If you go on YouTube, if you, it's December 12th, 2012, I believe.
2012?
Okay. But so one of the kind of funny, cute stories.
It's amazing that was like 13 years ago.
Too. I know, right?
Like that's a long time ago.
We all gathered at Kim's house the night before, and I had my one of my kids, I had my granddaughter. We all brought our family, and we're making posters, and we were all flat broke. None of us had money. But I let it slip that I had 10 bucks. And they all just looked at me and went,
bougie.
Ooh, we need yellow ribbon. I'm like, fuck, okay, I'm going to Walmart to buy yellow ribbon for our banner. So that was where my last 10 bucks went. I think I had like just about a half a tank of gas left. So we had that big rally, and then we knew we needed to continue to do more, that it wasn't enough just to have the rally. Right? And one of the beautiful chants that came out, we didn't plan for the chants, but we were also really, really clear that we were not wearing masks. We were not hiding our faces. Because we had nothing to, we felt we had nothing to
hide.
To fear, nothing to hide.
Yeah.
We're straight up. This is what the deal is. And so after the rally, we got together and knew we needed to do more. So we started, we're like, well, let's organize a flash mob. So we organized our first flash mob for December 26th at the, is it TD Square downtown? That
yeah,
big,
the old TD Square. Now it's like Dominion Square or something like that.
I have no idea. Yeah. I don't even come downtown.
Yeah. But it
anymore.
Used to be TD Square.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And myself, Summer was parking her vehicle, but myself, Autumn, and Kim were sitting in the second cup. And we're just all looking at each other, just real nervous. Because we didn't even know if anybody was going to show up.
Yeah.
We had no idea. Mm-hmm. We had put the call out, we'd asked for drummers, and we didn't even know if we were going to have, because we were just, yeah. Right? So at about, and that was to start at 3 o'clock, so about 10 to 3, mm. We went up to the, we were making our way up to the third floor, and just before 3, drummer showed up, boom, 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 and we started. And literally out of, I don't know, where the people came from, but out of there, mm-hmm. on 3 levels, you had people dancing. We were round mm-hmm. dancing, right? And security was running around because they didn't know what to do because the fucking Indians are here and they're dancing. What are we going to do? That's like a scary thing, right? So
surprised they didn't have the riot team come in and get you out.
They did bring police in, but yeah. Because there was no, people weren't, we weren't blocking entrances. Mm-hmm. We were very clear about how to do this in a good way mm-hmm. to get our point out. And we organized several mm-hmm. Around the city. We also organized teach-ins. And one of the last teach-ins, I believe, we did upstairs in the big room.
Mm, okay.
Right? Educating non-Indigenous people about why we were doing what we were doing mm-hmm. and how you can be a good ally and how you can support. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, so I have good memories from that. It was challenging, but it was good. Mm-hmm. It was great to see the to see people come together. We just lost. It's been a couple of years now. Yeah, because it was during COVID, and we lost one of our great warriors, Roy Little Chief, mm-hmm. and he was like an old AIM guy.
Okay.
And Roy taught me yeah. a lot. Like right Roy on. Taught me a lot.
For those out there, AIM is the American Indian Movement.
Oh yeah, yeah. So okay.
Well, because lots of people have been taught that AIM is a terrorist group. So that's why I'm clarifying it a little bit, is because folks that are non-Indigenous, like myself, yeah. we were raised to believe that the AIM, like I was raised in the California, so we were taught that AIM is like a terrorist group. So basically, when the FBI went on the nation and took care of AIM, that was good being done, right? So lots of non-Indigenous humans may still have that picture in their mind that the American Indian Movement are terrorists. They are not.
Yeah, no, absolutely yeah. not. It was 100%
always...
100% not. They didn't fashion themselves after the work of the Black Panthers, mm-hmm. right? Which who did go out and have actions, mm-hmm. but they also fed people. They yep. also had libraries. They had yep. they got kids to school. They had lunch programs.
Mutual aid was huge,
right? Right, yeah. And so when people don't know or just accept what they're mm-hmm. being fed, and we used to say, well, you know, like just. Go and find out for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think the word is now, like, do your own research, yeah. right? But that's become a real scary thing because you got people, well, I did my own research and those vaccines and mm-hmm. this and that and COVID. And like so yeah. so all the, I think actually 9/11 really started a lot of those conspiracy mm-hmm. theories.
Yeah. Well, 9/11 was a changing point for the whole world, right? It was carte blanche for one superpower to just obliterate another power, right? Mm-hmm. And whatever they wanted to do, they were allowed to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And they controlled the narrative the whole way.
Yeah. They totally did. And that continues to this very day.
Yeah.
So once they started to erode people's freedoms mm-hmm. and rights, right? And Americans are big on their rights and especially their Second Amendment, right?
Yeah.
But
well, they're big on some of their rights, but
not all the rights. Yeah, yeah. And not for everybody.
And not for everyone, that's right.
Right, right. Just only those Confederate guys.
Yeah.
Or some of those other folks. Yeah. But yeah, so when rights started to be eroded, it just really gave license to mm-hmm. governments. And governments around the world really paid attention to what the Americans were doing because they did it very stealth. Mm-hmm. And it was done in such a way that people didn't even realize what they were giving up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right? Because we need to keep America safe.
The Patriot Act.
Oh, yes. Right? Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
That was the sign that everything was changing for mm-hmm. the worse, mm-hmm. right? Was mm-hmm. when they can imbibe the Patriot Act on anything they want, and it gives them carte blanche, just walk into your house and do whatever they want.
Oh,
because
yeah.
you could be a terrorist.
Yeah, you right? could be.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can remember being at City Hall, gosh, man, over a decade ago now, easy over a decade, when we were holding marches for Palestine then, mm-hmm. our rallies, and there yeah. was like 20 of us.
I was going to say, it just wouldn't have been as like...
No.
Because we've all been taught our anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab like biases from the time we're little, right? In North America, well, pretty much anti-brown, really.
Anti-people of color.
Yeah, anti-people of color. I mean, I could just say that for sure. Yeah.
So I remember us being there, and I remember speaking at those rallies, and there was a really small, dedicated group. And for me, as an Indigenous woman, I relate very strongly with what. Of what the plight of that particular group of human beings. Mm. And people forget these are human beings.
Yeah.
These aren't others, they're human beings. Mm-hmm. Right? And
it's genocide in real time.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah.
It's
right in front of our eyes.
Yeah. When, I mean, I can't now, after what are we, 5 months, going on 6 months
six
now?
6 months almost, yeah. It's gotta be close, yeah.
I can't look at another picture of a Palestinian child dying or a parent sobbing, holding their
child.
Their child.
That has no life anymore.
Or seeing men do move with their hands because there's no equipment there to move rubble off because there could be people alive mm-hmm. under that. It's
horrifying.
You can only sit and sob on your couch and then feel so helpless. And so, you know, for the folks here who have been so diligent mm-hmm. in their organization and so committed to not only organizing the rallies mm-hmm. and ensuring, and I love that about what Wassam, and yeah. I think Wassam is probably one of the most deadly people out there in a
yeah,
big
he's
way.
He's pretty rad.
Oh, my
he's
God.
Pretty rad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We were lucky enough to have him on, so.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's.
Amazing, amazing caring human, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So between, you know, Justice for Palestinians and all the other groups who've come together, mm-hmm. Independent Jewish Voices,
yeah.
Ronnie Lee, and oh man, sometimes I'm bad with names.
It's okay,
but I can see their faces, you know, that show up, and then you start seeing people around the world mm-hmm. who happen to be Jewish, you know, holding up signs saying, not in my name.
Yeah.
And as an Indigenous person, the genocide that was inflicted here with the blessing
yep.
of people, of the governments
yep.
in power at that time. My own family on my mom's side is, so we come through, so my family is the first cousin to Louis Riel. And, and so if we look even back at that resistance, they've labeled it as a rebellion, but we've always called it a resistance because mm-hmm. we were resisting the feds taking our land. And mm-hmm. so just a little bit of history. So Riel was in Montana. He was actually a little batshit crazy, mm-hmm. Super religious, super religious, super Catholic, super religious. So my ancestor, Charles Nolan, was kind of the leader in the Métis community at that time. And so they knew this was coming. And Nolan was smart enough to know that he was not the guy to lead this. Mm-hmm. He knew that they needed Riel. And so these two cousins had a love-hate relationship with each other. They were either the best of buds or the worst of enemies. And so he gathered the people, and then there's a proclamation that was done, and Dumont and three others went to Montana to bring Riel up to Saskatchewan and started that planning for that battle.
Yeah.
And so shortly after Riel got there, they had a disagreement of sorts, and so Nolan left. And then also right around that same time, Wandering Spirit headed up to Frog Lake, where it's called the Frog Lake Massacre, where six non-Indigenous people were killed by his warriors. Mm-hmm. Poundmaker sent warriors. Crowfoot did not. Mm-hmm. And let me back up a little bit before that, because at Siksika, at the river, there was a camp that Crowfoot, Poundmaker, and Riel all had camp together just before all this was going down. So they sent Father Lacombe down to have a conversation with Crowfoot, and Crowfoot didn't send warriors to fight. And I believe that in a good churchy way that Father Lacombe got the message to Crowfoot that what's one of the ways that he could stop those people? Well, he could stop their rations. Mm-hmm. He could stop the food. Mm-hmm. So as a leader, well, you're going to send warriors and then you're going to starve your people? Well, he wasn't prepared to do that. Mm-hmm. That's what I really truly believe what happened. Mm-hmm. So shortly after that, Nolan left and they captured Nolan. They also charged him with treason. They charged mm-hmm. Wandering Spirit with treason. They hung Wandering Spirit and they cut a deal with Charles Nolan. Mm-hmm. And the deal was that once this was all over, because the feds were convinced they were going to win, because we didn't have, I think they called them Gatling guns back mm-hmm. in the day.
Yeah.
These guys had those muskets where you have yeah. to load one shot at a time, yeah. everybody take it down and then, you know, plug mm-hmm. it again. And and so Nolan did testify against Riel at his trial. Mm-hmm. And part of that agreement was that he would never, ever again, ever participate in anything pertaining to Métis politics. Mm-hmm. So he went and lived his life off, the rest of his life, as a farmer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, just a little bit of history that it's not in the history books.
Yeah.
But we know that history.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and so you've like found your way into this, like it's like kind of a family thing.
It's a DNA thing, yeah.
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 In terms of being involved yeah. in like protests. So does most of your music have to do with protest stuff? Like is it normally geared around like protest themes
yeah.
kind of thing?
Yeah.
Cool.
Around one of the last shows we just did, which I was so grateful because it was sold out, which was awesome.
That's awesome.
so I have a band called Walker and the Tribe, and mm-hmm. The tribe is non-native. Mm-hmm. And I like that for a couple of reasons. One is that so you've got a Native woman in the front and you've got mm-hmm. these white guys behind her, and girl, woman.
Yeah.
So there's that visual, mm-hmm. right? So, and sometimes a visual can say mm-hmm. a lot more than what words can necessarily say. Mm-hmm. And so I told everybody that when we were doing going to do the show, I was going to get up there first and I was going to just be me and the guitar. And I was going to open with Blowing in the Wind, mm-hmm. talking about a revolution, mm-hmm. and Won't Back Down.
It's good stuff.
Right? And then they came up, and then we rocked it up, and we started, I think it's called Indian Reservation. We call it Cherokee People, mm-hmm. A song from the 60s that Paul Revere and the Raiders did. I found one night going down that a couple years ago, going down that, you know, that YouTube rabbit hole.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like, this yeah. is, I love this song.
Yeah.
I love this song. So yeah. we've kind of just, so a lot of our stuff is geared musically to around making those statements, musically mm-hmm. to around making people aware of not only what happened to Indigenous people, but what continues to happen to Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. Last year, I released a single called And the Children. Mm-hmm. So my dad went to residential school, and he had a grade 6 education, if that's what we would mm-hmm. liberally call it, mm-hmm. or generously call it.
Generously, yeah.
Generously,
that's
call
generous.
It. Anyway, so he had, you know, like when you're learning how to write when you're a kid, mm-hmm. your writing is not very good.
Yeah.
Right? His writing looked like that his whole life. Mm-hmm. And where was I going with that?
You were talking about him coming out of residential school. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a whole point, and then I segued myself right out of that whole conversation. So I'm so sorry about that.
No, it's okay. It happens all the time.
So him being that survivor, he was not a good human. Mm. He was not a good person. He was not a good father. But one of the takeaways stories that I will tell about him and in his determination mm-hmm. was he always wanted to learn how to fly a plane. Mm. But he had this grade 6 education. And he worked between hunting and trapping. He was also a painter, mm. right? So he'd come into town, work, make some money, and go back to the bush. So he took me because I would be the one who would often talk for him, or I would explain things to people. And so we're at this flight school, and it was in Abbotsford because we were living in BC at that time. And so the guy looks at my dad's application. He could see this like kid's scrawl, this terrible writing, and that, you know, he was honest and that he only completed grade six. So he looks at me, he said, "I'm really sorry." He said, "But we can't accept you here because you wouldn't ever be able to do the math, because the math is really complicated when you're flying a plane." And so I remember my dad saying, "Is that right, eh?" So then my dad says to him, he goes, "So tell me, how many square feet is this hangar?" The guy goes, "I don't know." So my dad, I can't remember the number, it was hundreds of square feet. And then my dad says to him, he goes, "How many gallons of paint would it take to paint this and not have very much left over? Because if you have too much left over, you don't make enough money, right?" And the guy goes, "I don't know. Why are you asking me these questions?" And my dad's comeback was perfect. It was like, he said, "I think it's you who can't do the math." And so he actually did go on to learn how to fly a plane.
Yeah.
And he actually did go on to actually get a sailboat, and he learned how to sail from, by that time he found his way into Ontario. And he sailed by himself all the way to the Philippines and spent a good many years living there. So that determination that he instilled in us was profound. And so that lesson, my takeaway, even though there was some real horror stuff that happened. But my takeaway, what I choose to take away from that as I work through my own trauma and healing, is that you don't back down. Just because somebody tells you, "No, it can't be done," you're like, "Really? Well, let me, what's plan B?" Okay, plan B is not working. What's plan C? What's plan D? And you keep going until you get the answer that you need to get to do what you need to do. And so for that, I've always been extremely grateful for that teaching.
Yeah, no doubt.
Right?
Because in order to be like an activist of any kind, you've got to be willing to like stick it out.
Oh, yeah. It's...
Because it's hard on the body, hard on the mind, hard on the soul.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've sat in my own place and, you know, just literally sobbed. Not only during this whole Palestinian situation that is continuing, but in other situations and within my own family of, you know, people dying of drug overdoses, of people. One of my cousins was murdered in Montreal and nobody ever investigated that. And so if I'm so overwhelmed by that, I still need to be able to reach into, one needs to be able to reach into themselves to find that, what is the French say, je ne sais quoi, that certain little, whatever that is, that causes you to get up the next day and the next day and the next day, no matter what's going on in your own life, no matter what you may be facing within your family or within your own self, be it with work or kids or life, you still need to show up and you need to give everything that you have into that particular action, whatever the action is.
Yeah.
Whatever the action is.
Yeah.
Right.
Wild. Yeah. That's far out. That's amazing.
It's just how, it's how I've just lived my life. And, I'm not always the most popular girl.
Yeah. Well, sometimes popularity is kind of a misguided like goal, I think, right? For lots of folks. To be popular is not the purpose.
Yeah.
And it's okay to be that way if you are. Like,
well, one would like to be kind of a little, certainly in music, and kind of going back to just finishing up that part of the conversation. So yeah, a lot of the music that I write is around, like we've got this one piece that I co-wrote with another Métis woman called Revaillé. Now, that word is not even mentioned in the song, but it just starts off. Phantom horsemen appeared in the dead of the night. We have a message for you. Play your trump card tonight. We asked who. Tell us who. Bad news travels fast. Give the devil his due. There's an eastern wind coming. It's coming for you, and we knew. And so that song talks about just before the Battle at Batoche, right? So Oh yes, I was talking about and the children. Mm-hmm. That's where I segued right. myself That's out. Right. Yeah. Sometimes you just gotta circle back mm-hmm. and come. So once the 215 were found at Kamloops, I also want to just backtrack. What I was teaching at Muscogee's High School, communication technology, mm-hmm. and I suck at technology, so it was amazing that I got put in that position. Because one of the people that I knew there came and picked me up at lunch hour and said, I want to show you something. And so we went for a drive, and this person took me to a garage that was still quite dilapidated, but mm-hmm. still standing. And this person said, this is where the priests would bring us. Mm-hmm. And he shared his story. So his story always stayed with me. Only once did my dad ever talk about his own
experience there,
which involved being raped and beaten and all of that stuff. And he literally once talked about it, and it was only for a few minutes, because a lot of those old people never ever talked about what happened.
It'd be terrifying,
right? So now Kamloops is found, and people in the community had been saying for years that we knew there was unmarked graves. We knew there was some folks, I remember hearing one number of 50,000, they believed in total that never came back home. And so
I would say at least.
Yeah. So once that started, I started to write a piece called And the Children. And it was about the children who died, not the ones, not the survivors, but those who didn't die. I mean, those who did die. And so, again, a very incredible, difficult piece to write, but really, I thought, critically important for whatever reason that I needed to put this out there. Mm-hmm. And so, I have to, real quick story. So my violin player, she's amazing, Alex. She's just, she's one of the most super, uber talented musicians you're ever going to meet. Yeah. And so we were hanging out at my place one night, and I'd gotten a quote from a studio, and Alex says, I know 10 people who could give us $50. You know 10 people who could give us $50. That gives us $1,000. That gives us enough to go in and record the song. So we're like all pumped up. So we worked out the arrangement. We worked out everything for the song. Then we go and tell this other Métis friend of ours, Patricia. And Patricia's like, that's not how you raise money. And we're like, oh, we thought it was such a great idea. She goes, no, this is what you do. And then she took it over. And we literally raised $3,700.
Nice.
Literally off of Facebook, off my band page, which if anybody wants to check it out, it's called Walker and the Tribe. And so...
Yeah, check it out. Yeah. Check out the music.
So we recorded the song. We were able with... Like, we stretched that money. Like, you couldn't have gotten, you know, a quarter of a penny out of it by the time we were done with it. Because we were able to do a real simple video. And so the song was nominated last year at the Calgary YYC Music Awards. Now, it didn't... A lot of other Indigenous people I know also had stuff nominated, but they didn't make it through. So they we didn't fit into country, we didn't fit into folk, we didn't fit into blues. So they stuck us in world for a bit, and then they kind of bounced us out of world into the People's Choice Awards. And I didn't think we had much of a shot at winning that, simply because... we were up against a choir of 400 people. And so it was literally people, you know, voting online, right? And so if you look at 400 people and their contacts, we were actually apparently a close second, but, you know. And then somebody said, well, what if you don't win? I said, you know what? It's kind of like having cake. The nomination is the cake. If one wins, that's the icing. But at the end of the day, you still got cake. And then the other thing that kind of came up for me was noticing how there was some other Indigenous artists from this area who did not make it through. I'm like, well, that's not right. Their music's kind of different because I went and listened to what they were doing and what they put out there. And I thought, I'm going to do something about this. I don't know what it is just yet, but I'm going to fix this somehow. So then... I was in the middle of planning a tribute, putting a tribute show together for the now that we know Italian, Buffy St. Marie. And I had a meeting at the National Music Center for that tribute. Well, that wasn't going to happen. And the gal that I was meeting with, Stephanie, super sweet woman, was also the president of YYC. Mm. And I said, I want to come back and have a conversation with you about Indigenous music and the awards. When can we do that? So she told me when it was time. So I went back in that time frame, and her and I went back and forth a wee bit. But I'm really super happy to say that this year at YYC 2024, there will be the inaugural Indigenous Artist of the Year Music Award.
Excellent.
I know, right?
That's like, fantastic.
I know. So it is because I believe that it's not just about me. It's about all of us. Mm-hmm. And that if I have the opportunity to open the door a bit, mm-hmm. then I owe it to my community to bring them with me. Mm-hmm. And so musically, the way that I can do that mm-hmm. is to make this happen. Mm-hmm. We've just, in music again, we've just started, we've got quite some more shows coming up, but going into mainstream music venues, mm-hmm. which would never before have us.
Yeah, that's and awesome.
And so now it's up to us to fill the rooms.
Yeah.
Right? It's great for the venue because they get mm-hmm. people coming in, but it's really up to us to fill the rooms.
Yeah.
And so by filling those rooms, we did the last one. We have one coming up on April 5th at Congress Cafe at 8 p.m., myself and my band, and this super uber amazing Blackfoot duo called mm-hmm. Winter Count.
Okay.
Will and Ty. I've invited them to also be part of that show.
Right on.
And it's, so the more that we are able to get out into mainstream music venues and the more that people come out and support us, mm-hmm. then it pushes that envelope a little further.
Yeah.
It opens that space up where you can say there is space for us mm-hmm. in the Calgary music scene
yeah.
and that people want to hear what we have to say
for
or
sure.
what we have to sing. Mm-hmm. So I hope that folks will not only support myself, but will mm-hmm. support other Indigenous artists who are out there.
Yeah.
You know, again, in their own way, trying to push that envelope.
Mm-hmm. That's rad.
Yeah.
And I hope so too. I mean, that's part of why we just share all kinds of different stories on here is because what we want is to share that, right? And to try to get to people who might not ever hear Indigenous music, right?
Like, yeah.
Because maybe yeah. they're afraid of it. Maybe they don't know what it sounds like or what they, you know what I mean? And so to be able to get more widespread representation is obviously a positive, right?
Absolutely. And, mm-hmm. and I know for myself, I've kind of slated myself in kind of terms of that social justice type of music.
Yeah.
And I'm really okay doing that because it's, again, I believe that music travels much further than mm-hmm. sometimes a rally or sometimes a politician. Mm-hmm. And if you can get one person in that audience leaving and thinking about us in a different way, mm-hmm. then, you know, hopefully they'll go home and have conversations with their own family and mm-hmm. go, you know what, I saw this and I never thought about that before mm-hmm. or I never knew that before. Mm-hmm. And so that way we can also begin to educate mm-hmm. People. And that's, the arts are a powerful tool for
powerful
that.
Powerful education tool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we look at Martin Scorsese's film, mm-hmm. Killers of the Flower Moon, mm-hmm. which, I don't, have you seen it yet?
Yeah.
I've seen it several times. I really liked it.
Maybe mad, but...
Yeah, but what he did...
Well done.
Yeah. So well done, because what he shows is he is showing the greed mm-hmm. and what people will do for money, mm-hmm. right? Which is such a foreign concept for an Indigenous way of thinking, mm-hmm. right? Because for us, the more... like when we have round dances or powwows, we have giveaways, mm-hmm. right? So for us, the richer you are, the more you give, mm-hmm. right? So it's that, so it's a really different philosophy. And he told that story so beautifully. Mm-hmm. They were just all so good in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, just a beautifully acted, beautifully filmed movie, for mm-hmm. sure. And a terrifying subject.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's,
genocide.
Absolutely. Yeah. Another, and you know, it wasn't just... you know, in that they showed, I think it was it Henry and a few other guys who were murdered, but it was really, they went after, again, they go after the women, mm-hmm. right? So women have been that target.
Yeah.
Even here in Canada, where First Nations women, if they married, it didn't even matter if they married a Métis man, they lost status. Mm-hmm. And it was a group of women out of Saddle Lake who really fought for Bill C-34 to make that happen.
And that allows women to keep their status, right?
It allows them to reapply. For their
So they have to reapply after they get married to a non-Indigenous person.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, none of us know that.
Yeah.
None of us know that shit. We just think, and like lots of us too, also think that status is anything but control, right? And we know that status is to control. Is so that the government could know exactly where people are that they want to know where they are, right?
I was in a shop some years ago on 17th Avenue, just kind of browsing, killing some time. And the young man that worked in the shop came up to me. We had a little conversation. He goes, oh, it's because, if you don't mind me asking, he said, but are you Native? And I said, yeah, I know. Don't let these green eyes fool you. Very Native. And he said, oh, he goes, what do you do? And so I told him, well, I work in the arts. And he goes, well, it must be really easy for you, you know, because you get all this free money. I said, free money?
Yeah.
He said, yeah, all that free money you guys get. I said, what free money? Because I'm really racking my brain, like, what's he talking about?
Yeah.
He goes, yeah, the free money. And I'm like, oh, I know what you're talking about. He goes, yeah, the free money. I said, yes, the $5 a year. And then just the look, he said, $5? I said, yeah, that's why they call it treaty days oftentimes. And they'll have a big, you know, people have, communities will have big, they'll do a whole bunch of
gatherings
and different things at that time. And some people don't get their $5. They'll wait 10 years and they walk out, they got $50, right? So, and then even here for, in Alberta, which Alberta is really unique when it comes to Métis people, because we have what's called Métis Settlements General Council. And so up in northern Alberta, you have the settlements, and you have the settlements, which is like, because it's they're that land base is close to a reserve. So, so for example, by Frog Lake, you will have Fish and Lake Métis Settlement. By Cold Lake First Nations, you have Elizabeth Métis Settlement.
Okay.
And so settlement is a little different and governs itself differently than, say, citizens from the Métis Nation of Alberta who, in order to receive certain benefits or certain rights, then you must be able to trace your roots back to the Red River. And so I remember once I was flying out of Ottawa and I had my Métis card and... for some reason, I didn't have my driver's license. I don't know where it was. It was actually at home. But so the only photo ID I had was my citizenship card. And so I said, "Well, here's my ID." And they're like, "Well, we don't recognize that." And I said, "Well, you should, because I said First Nations, Métis, Inuit people, we are part of the Constitution. So that's my ID." And they said, "Well, is it a status card?" I went, "No, it's not a status card. It's a citizenship card." And they literally held up the plane. And now they're on the phone trying to find out how they could verify this card. And it was actually after, it was actually like 7 o'clock at night. So finally, after about 20 minutes, they said, "We can't reach anybody. Just, ma'am, just go on the plane." And I got to tell you, the people who were sitting on the plane waiting for me were not happy when I walked on. No, and I don't blame them because, you know, like you're 20 minutes late in taxiing and getting out and going to, coming back to Calgary.
Well, and they don't know what happened.
No, they just know like, well, she's late.
Obviously, she was causing a problem.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I see in terms of the challenges that we face here, certainly not anywhere what we have seen the escalation of what's happening in Palestine. And yet, when we look back at, if we look back historically, some of those same challenges did happen.
Of course they happened.
In residential school. You had kids who were starved. There's a...
Well, South Africa based their apartheid on ours.
Yes, they most certainly did.
Yeah.
How do you deal with the Indian problem?
Yeah.
Or the Native problem?
Yeah.
There's a video out there, and it's really hard to watch, but it's based, it's not very long, a little documentary. And I know when I was going, when I went back to university a couple years ago through Royal Road University out of Victoria, in the program that I was taking, I had to watch this video. And it was on this island called Cooper Island, where they sent a bunch of Native kids to school. And And much like...
was that out east, Cooper Island? Or
I believe it's off the coast of BC.
Coast of BC, okay.
And much like Holocaust survivors, they also had numbers, right?
Yeah.
And so the good, I think they were brothers. Mm. I forget what order or whatever they were. Anyways, one of them would walk onto the field and they would call out a number. And that child, you would see that child would hang its head because now that child had to go to the, go with that priest. Mm. Many of those children ended up in the infirmary, perforated bowels. And
she got a sick feeling, man.
But this is part of the reality, and this is part of the truth, and this is part of what needs to come out. So that when you see that Indigenous person on the street, you understand why that person's there. There isn't one child anywhere in this world that when you ask a kid, what do you want to be when you grow up? Oh, I want to be this, I want to be that. No little boy or girl who's Indigenous says, well, I want to be an alcoholic, a drug addict, and homeless or houseless. Right? That's just, right? That's not what people want to grow up to be.
Well, and then kids who are people of color, Indigenous, Black people, raised in our culture, in Western culture here, they're given the lie that they're treated the same as everyone else.
Yeah, it's
like, and that's the biggest lie. And then we're given it too. Don't get me wrong. As a white kid, we grew up thinking that everybody was the same because that's what they wanted us to think, right? That that everybody had the same opportunities. Because, I mean, and then they talked about the free money that Indigenous people got, right? Like, I knew that was a scam from like conservative white folk long time ago. But I still heard it anyway,
I
still hear it today from people where, oh, they all free money, hey?
Yeah, and you don't pay tax.
Yeah, well, you know, I think if someone tried to eradicate my whole entire like family
existence,
I think I might be entitled to some sort of compensation. I know it's not how it works, but I'm just saying, like in general, to those people out there who think it's free money, whatever the money might be.
It's $5. It's that treaty money, and that's just for First Nations people. Yeah. The Inuit have their own agreements with the with the federal government. The Métis Nation of Alberta actually has a bill. Is it 53 or 58? It's one of those two numbers that would determine or give the Métis Nation that designation as being self-governed and self-governing. Mm-hmm. There's two groups out of northern Alberta that are fighting that, and that is the Fort McKay Métis, who said we never agreed and we're not under the Métis Nation. So we have our own internal political stuff that goes on.
Well, there's lateral violence in every community, unfortunately.
Yeah. So I would really just encourage people to have conversations with Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And these are not easy conversations to have. Real quickly, because I know we're running out of time here.
Yeah, it's okay. We're coming to that.
But I was playing a few years ago at this private party. And this sweet little white lady comes up to him and she says, I'm so glad we got reconciliation now. And I said, well, ma'am, we got a bridge.
Yeah.
And she's like, no. We have reconciliation. I'm like, no, we don't, ma'am. Mm-hmm. And I said, and I don't actually know if we will ever have reconciliation in this country. Mm-hmm. And she was like, what do you mean? I said, well, in order for us to have actual reconciliation, you have to be willing to sit there and listen.
The truth.
Listen to the truth of what truly happened to First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people in this land. Mm-hmm. You have to be willing to be so uncomfortable when you hear about rape and torture and starvation and genocide and murder. I said, ma'am, are you prepared for that yet? Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, ma'am, you have to hear about it, about your priests doing it, your cops doing it, your politicians doing it. That's what you have to understand, is that it was people who looked like you. Now, it wasn't you, but it was people who looked like you and claimed to be all for all this, like, love, peace, and all that shit.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, what's happening to the children and to adults.
Like, yeah, exactly.
And I appreciate you tying it into what's happening in Palestine. And
As a
non-Indigenous person, it looks the same. Like, it just really does.
It does.
Yeah.
When you go back to 1947 or 48?
Something like that, yeah.
May 14th. And you look at the Palestinian land, and then you look at, I truly believe the state of Israel was created out of guilt. Mm. Because you had the British and the French in there. Mm-hmm. And everybody felt guilty after what had happened to the horrificness of the loss of 6 million lives in
World
death
War
camps,
II.
Right? Yeah. And so Canada even, there was a boatload, a whole shipload of Jewish people, mm-hmm. and they were turned away.
Yeah, same from the States.
Right. So we were complicit, mm-hmm. or the country, or the government was complicit in that.
And we still are.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so then the powers that be then got together and they created the State of Israel, mm-hmm. and they forced marched over 750,000 Palestinians mm-hmm. out of their homes.
Yeah.
Out of their homes. And you had now people who had homes and lives that were just torn and ripped away. And now they're living in tents.
That's right. And that was after, like, because in like 18 something something, there was like the colonizers, the British, yeah. French, and others were involved too. But there was something called the white papers that were done. And I know it's not, for those out there listening, it doesn't mean it was like white supremacist papers. It was like, it was literally like a document that was Zionist to say this is going to be Israel's one day,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
No matter who's there.
Yeah, and prior to that, you had there was Jewish people living
yeah.
there. There was Arab people living there.
Christians,
there was
Arabs, everyone.
And they all coexisted.
Yeah.
There's a documentary I would encourage people to watch. It's on YouTube. If you type in first female hijacker, mm-hmm. was a Palestinian woman.
Okay.
Yeah, and I can't remember the it's so good.
Oh, I'm going to look it up too.
Oh, yeah, it is so good.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
And I imagine what she was talking about was obviously what's happening today, like
yeah,
in a different
back then, like in this, I think it was in the 1970s,
yeah,
right. So Palestinians have been standing up time and time and time again, year after year after year, mm-hmm. No one has listened, no one paid attention. Everybody's like, well, you know, Israel, mm-hmm. right, and so. For myself, I am most definitely not anti-Semitic.
I don't think it has anything to do with religion.
No.
But that's my opinion.
But mine too. But there's people out there who want to make it about that.
100%.
And then if you speak against what's happening, well, then you have to be anti-Semitic. No, what I am is anti-genocide.
Yeah.
I am anti-famine. I am anti-murder.
I'm totally anti-murder for sure.
Right? I'm anti over 14,000 innocent, beautiful children. And not one person, when I engage in those conversations with people out there, I've asked them, so how did over 30,000 innocent Palestinian men, women, and children, what have they got to do with Hamas? Mm-hmm. So how is Israel, how come we're not hearing the news like that they've killed Hamas leaders or the warriors, right?
Yeah, it's because they say that Hamas uses all those people as cover.
Oh, that's bullshit.
I know, right? Like, it's such horseshit. Yeah, they used 30,000 people as cover, and that's what Israel did. No, Israel doesn't give a shit.
No.
And it's not about, like, religion. And I'm not, because I'm not anti-Semitic.
No,
I'm not
absolutely.
Anti-anything, really, except for murder, genocide,
and
colonization, and people who don't want to be colonized.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So like you, I will continue to show up.
Yeah.
I will continue to stand up. I will continue to speak out. And even when it's uncomfortable, I will continue to do that.
Right.
I believe that is my moral obligation to my fellow human being. Mm-hmm. And you notice, because how I was taught by my elders is that Creator put all the people on the earth, mm-hmm. red, white, black. So we are all connected, right? We mm-hmm. all have, there isn't a woman from whatever race mm-hmm. that I can't sit down with and have a cup of coffee or tea and talk about my kids or my grandkids. Mm-hmm. We all, right, so we have more in common. Mm-hmm. But what these governments like to do is they like the word diversity. I've never been a fan of that because diversity keeps us looking at our differences, mm-hmm. not at our sameness, not at our connectedness.
Our humanness.
Yeah. Not at our humanness
yeah.
and how we are all human beings on this earth. Mm-hmm. And we all want the same thing for our families. Yeah. We all want the same thing.
Yeah, right on. Thank you so much.
You're so
That's
welcome.
A perfect way to end it. I like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you for coming on.
You're welcome.
Right on. And that was Wendy Walker. Check out the band.
Walker and the Tribe.
Yep. Walker and the Tribe.
And if you are around on April 5th at Congress Cafe, it's in the Northeast, at 8 o'clock, Winter Count and Walker and the Tribe will be taking the stage. April 19th, Walker and the Tribe will be at Asylum for the Arts. Come on out. April 27th, we will be at Jam's Diner in Inglewood. And then we have some other May dates and mm-hmm. June dates that are coming up.
Right on.
So
check them out. Facebook page.
And also, lastly, if you are so inclined, go on Bandcamp. under Wendy Walker, and you will see, and the children, you will see a new single we just released called Sign from a film I just released.
Right on.
And a jazz piece that I did with the Jazz Collective off one of my songs.
Cool.
And I think they give you 3 free listens before you pay the $2 or whatever the cost is. And you can also go on SoundCloud under Wendy Walker, and there's some free music for you to listen to.
Right on.
My gift to all of you.
Oh, thank you so much. And seriously, check it out. Her music is great. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me,
David. My pleasure.